Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 21st, 1999, and in the fireside room this afternoon, Edna Hansen will continue her series on the brain. This is called The Body-Brain Connection, The Wholeness of Our Being. This is tape 99-6. So now let's join Edna.
Access, could I see? Besides, I own here, it's been too many. Okay. What we put up here, these were some of the things we looked at in the previous classes. Talked about the left-right brain, and I'll put my brain together here since my husband made me a stand. I don't have to have Karen or someone, other nice person to hold it. Can be stable by itself here. And this explains some of the parts that I'll be talking about as I put it together. Everyone, of course, is interested in reading, and some of the reading particulars here that have to do with the brain we have listed. I didn't introduce myself. I'm Edna Hansen, and I have a research center on Whidbey Island that has been a nonprofit educational research center since 1989. And my research has to do with children and the affect of certain kinds of processes now being done in the schools in the early grades, and the effect it has on vision and sensory integration, body alignment, etc. And we have 15 children each year, from start at 4.5, and they stay for 2 years, actually to the sixth year. And then we have them go hopefully to school. Some of them do homeschool. And we have them examined for vision acuity when they first come into the class. And they are examined at the end of the year. We follow a school year. The reason we're doing this is because we are finding a great number of children who have to have prescription glasses by third or fourth grade. Actually, the stress factor that does not allow vision to complete maturation is until 6.5, 7. Now, doctors are saying it even takes longer because of our TV and some other factors that don't have us moving enough when we're very small. The effect of the stress in kindergarten will not show up until those later grades. Vision takes about 2.5 to 3 years to regress instead of going forward. What we hope to do is to show that the push academically isn't really physiologically attuned to where our children are. Genetically, we haven't changed too much. So that's basically what we do. I also work with some young people up through teenagers who have sensory integration problem. This is because their body alignment has not followed in track the way it should. This interferes with processes, even with problem solving, and we do some therapies with that. My great love is for infant care, and I have been very fortunate to be a friend of Magda Gerber, who came from Budapest, Hungary, during the Hungarian Revolution, and she went to first she came to Harvard University, and they were very impressed with Magda and her work that she had been involved in Budapest with a Dr. Emmy Pickler, who is a medical doctor. Dr. Pickler started a orphanage for children after the Second World War. Her way of having these little babies and infants and children cared for was so unusual. She elicited the help of women in the village to please give at least 2.5 or 3 hours each day to focus on one infant. And this they kept up for a number of years until the child was 4.5, 5 years old. The results of that kind of work resulted in some very famous people in Europe, doctors and lawyers and so forth. So it was based on neurological development because Amy Pickler was a medical doctor, And Magda was one of her students. Magda's now in her 80s, and she came to Harvard, to the States, and they did not have a department that dealt with early childhood. So she went over to Stanford University in California, where she and Dr. Tom Forrest, who's a neuropediatrician, founded RIE, R-I-E, which stands for Resources for Infant Educators. RIE training is pretty unusual, although many, many in this country have been trained in RIE. The training can take place in Los Angeles at the RIE Institute, where Magda resides, or at my center on Whidbey Island, which has been happening for the past 12 years. And this has always taken place in July, 2 weeks in July, this year the 12th to the 23rd. We can take, Magda loves it because we can only take 20 students, and these are teachers from university programs and colleges around the United States. I turned my lab school into a dormitory, and it's really very cozy, and everybody bonds together from Canada. We have a lot of Canadians come down because it's quicker to take it at my place. I mean, it's less expensive than going to Los Angeles. We become very close, and it's interesting to see what's happening in many different states with infant care. I won't elaborate on the infant care because it's pretty radical compared to what we have in the United States. But we have had many, many RIE babies that are now grown who are also involved in teaching and are in the universities themselves. And hopefully it will become more so. This year, because we've had 12 years of training, it's a two-week, 80-hour intensive program, we have trained 157 teachers, and we're having a reunion on Whidbey Island at Camp Casey, because I can't handle 157 people. Camp Casey is owned by Seattle Pacific University, and they turned this wonderful camp, which was a war established during the Second World War, and they have barracks, and they use it now for international soccer teams from all over the world and many, many other things. And we're going to have our reunion there this summer, which is real exciting. It will happen on the Friday, Saturday, and Sunday following the RIE training. And we're getting responses from everywhere, and it's wonderful, from New York and Maryland and where all these people have been coming from. This is a very special going on for me with the brain, because now I want to do the body-mind connection, which is what I feel is one of the most important ways to look at what God gave us in terms of this wonderful, wonderful brain. He wanted us to be whole. He wanted us to realize that in the body of Christ, we are one. And this was an amazing way that many doctors, you know, we think sometimes of science as being very unchristian, but there are many, many people in the field of medicine who are really there because God gave them the feeling that this was the most wonderful gift in the world, this human cell that becomes a human being. And one of those people, and you have the book here too, his name is Dr. Paul Brand. He's an Englishman, and his credits are phenomenal. He is the chief of rehabilitation branch of U.S. Public Health Service in the hospital in Carville, Louisiana, as well as being clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at Louisiana State University Medical School. He also did 18 years of brilliant pioneering research on the disease of leprosy in India. Dr. Brand has a long list of prestigious awards. His Christian faith permeated his life and thought. And that is the wonder of many, many people in the medicine field. His book is called Fearfully and Wonderfully Made. And so that's But there are so many others. I suppose some of you have read Dr. Lewis Thomas. He talked and wrote about the cell. He wrote, what was it, the Medusa and the Snail. Has anybody ever read that? That is a wonder, too, about creation and life. He said, considering the human body growing from the fertilization of a single egg, he wrote, the mere existence of that cell should be one of the greatest astonishments of the earth. People ought to be walking around all day, all through their waking hours, calling to each other in endless wonderment, talking of nothing except that cell. If anyone does succeed in explaining it within my lifetime, he said, I will charter a plane, a skywriting one, maybe a whole fleet of them, and send that aloft to write one great exclamation point after another until all my money runs out. Dr. Lewis, Lewis Thomas actually is a poet too. He's written so many beautiful poems about human creation. But many philosophers or actually St. Augustine wrote, men, this one really hit me, men go abroad to wonder at the height of mountains, at the huge waves of the sea, at the long courses of the rivers, at the vast compass of the ocean, at the circular motion of the stars, and they pass by themselves without wondering. And that's really, we are, you know, we're a wonderment, and we walk around every day and we breathe and we smell and we see and we think, and we don't really, you know, we should say thank God, like, you know, every 5 minutes, but even if we just realized it when we wake up in the morning, that would be great. And Dr. Brand liked to make the comparison. He said, Jesus departed, leaving no body on earth to exhibit the Spirit of God to an unbelieving world, except the faltering, bumbling community of followers, as us, who had largely forsaken him at his death. We are what Jesus left on earth. We're a visible community to embody him and represent him to the world. And that's really we are. And the community as such as is the body of Christ, just as we are one body. And that is really where I think of helping. All I want is for everyone to realize what a gift we have. And that the more you understand about the workings of the body, the more you're in a sense of wonder all the time. It's a phenomenal, and I work with children because they seem to have some of the sensibilities that some of us have become a bit, you know, we don't think about them so much. When a child touches, when they're very tiny, if you can see their explorations when they're 2 and 3, even younger, you get a sense of wonder on their face. It looks like each sensation that a child feels is like a miracle. And that's what they go through life. These little people are walking around getting all this sensory, you know, everything is new. And I just wonder why they just don't all light up like the 4th of July. Because every time you do feel a new sensation, you have tremendous activity in the brain. As I'm speaking, there's lots going on up there, and I think I should put the brain together. That looks fun, more than I want to talk about. I built this thing because it's just, I shouldn't call it a thing, it's God's creation, the best I could do. But there are many models of the brain. I was invited to a conference, and another woman had a brain, and it was plastic. And right after that, I was asked to talk to a group of teachers in the Alternative Education Association in Everett. And I thought, I have to make it beautiful. You know, I mean, it's a dull subject unless you recognize its beauty. So I got all this evening gown material that I could find to compose its parts. My husband made me a beautiful base, but it's so heavy. Everything my Dane husband makes in wood is weighs a ton. But I said, I can't put that in my suitcase. They won't let me on the boat. So when he's in the shop now, and this is the stand he made because Karen was kind enough to hold it the other day, and so did Susan, and I was grateful for that. This is only the brain stem, where the medulla and the pons are going up into the first part of the brainal cavity, and this has some basic relation to movement and minor skills, but it has one function that's vital, because it does allow the information from all of your appendages through the spinal column up through here to the finer parts, to the intricate center of the brain, which is called the limbic system. But before that, we have the cerebellum. And I have pictures of this here. This is called the little brain. When this comes together, I didn't say that in the beginning, the little fetal form in the uterus, when it's developing, looks just like this, only it's curved over there, and the little head comes up and becomes a humankind, which is a miracle. Anyway, this the thalamus, I'm getting that. Take it all out, and then it'll be easier. Children love to see this. I'm going over. I have a permission to go over to Narnia tomorrow to show the children. And after the cerebellum, which has many more functions than this, we didn't say in the beginning 20 years ago that it did have something to do with movement. Now we're finding that many parts of the brain have multiple connections through the nervous system that we ever dreamed about. This is the way with everything in brain research now. It comes at you so fast that it's a phenomena to even try to think about it. Every paper I get, I have to read 3 or 4 times. And this is the limbic system, and these are the thalamus. There are 2 of them, actually. They're not connected, but I had to hang them together there. This little limbic system consists of the hippocampuses that are supposed to look like little seahorses, and then the little medullas, like little acorns. All these now are connected with sensations, and this is, I want to get into the molecules of emotion and the real mind-body connection, but I wanted to ease into it today with just specifically looking at tactile abilities and tactile integration with the rest of the body, because that the molecules of emotion has to do with peptides and Lingads and things that are really medical. I'm trying to figure out how to put it together so that it's very understandable, like this simple rendition of the brain. And this little area here, as I said, my Velcro is wearing out. We do the best we can. This is the pituitary gland, a very, very important gland in your body that now has other related attributes. They used to say it basically was because it was a growth factor, how big or how small you would develop. And this comes around here and hooks on here, and this one comes here. I think you could do it. My friend here's into every. There you are. Now, the gray matter is vitally important because we have the corpus callosum, and that's that little bridge that allows the right and left brain to communicate with each other. And the more activated this corpus callosum is, the better we can solve problems and think. We are neither right-brained or left-brained. We have a tendency to function more in one than the other. Some of us are linear, we like math, and we have a lot of ability to look at logic, etc., but others are spatially, visibly able to look at the whole picture. Our artistic endeavor has usually been attributed to the right brain, but everything in the right brain needs the left brain to actually make it something that can be produced. writers have to have the writers who are creative with the visual imagery that goes with writing, but their left brain allows them the ability to write down the words because language is in the left brain. Now we're saying that it's in other places, because when you think about Japan, they read from the other side, they read much differently than we do in our books, and so we know that they're using a different kind of brain ability to read. So this corpus callosum is the crossing bridge, which is very important. And then, of course, the last is the cortex. This was the one that took me almost 2 weeks to 12 yards of tubing there to stuff. Anyway, this brain has been loaned out to the Science Center in Seattle and many, many places. And everybody takes very good care of it. There are pearls of wisdom in here, I like to mention, which you acquire. And this where it is brighter color than this, means that the electrical impulses are on at different areas of the brain at different times when you're doing different things. Right now, as I'm speaking, the language areas, but they are also related to the senses that I perceive what I'm talking about. So there's an integrated way that the electronic, that we are ultra high frequency beings. Electricity is flowing all over the place. So we'll put that on there. I think I lost part of my brain here. Okay. I will go home and read that book. Maybe I'll do it. I'll try to think about it tomorrow. Anyway, this is the the gift. This is bigger because on top of here we need like a helmet that they wear for bicycling or motorcycle riding. So you can see that this is quite large. I told people if they'll put their fists together like this. Now it's upside down because this could actually act as the brain stem. So you can see we have an upside down brain here. But we have the left and right brain. On top of that, we would put a great big pair of woolly gloves. And that would be like my gray matter there. And then on top of that, we would take some wonderful fibrous material. Or one thing I've told the children, you know those great big things you pack with that you break the bubbles in? Mm-hmm. Well, we have experimented that we could make a cap like that, and that could, you know, be an analogy for the cortex. So actually you see, when the children do that, they see the real intricate part of their brain, and then we talk about what goes over it. So you can see about the size of it. It's like this, not like this. Anyway, I would like to tell you about this very first thing we'll explore today, and that will be taction and the ability to distinguish all of the parts of our world that we have that we can explore with our fingers. This is very special to me. I happened to say to someone this morning that I think the reason that I'm interested in the tactile abilities is that I met Helen Keller as a child, and she really influenced my life. I wrote to her, and she wrote to me. And she was one of my guides and mentors, and I love her dearly. The way we'll look at it is tactile qualities, and this refers to touch, you know, pressure, heat, cold, wet, pain. You can think of many more in the fingertips, which are actually computers, because there are so many sensations, and each sensation has a different nerve ending. So you can see that the multiple amount of nerve endings that are in your fingertips are tremendous, going to the limbic, you know, going to the limbic system to give messages of what your sensation is. It is so vital. We've done many studies, and I know you've heard about the deprivation, sensory deprivation in apes. They've done it mostly in monkeys. How stressful it is, how depressed these little infants are that they did these experiments on. The same way with the baby, who must be totally cared for with soft coverings, but more than that, made aware that they have the ability with their little tiny fingers. If you do this with an infant that's having a kind of a rough time, you'd be surprised how easily they calm down just by rubbing on the surface. This doesn't actually startle them. If you rub them on other parts of their body, they'll go into a reflex position sometimes, which is called the Moro reflex. They have many ways to survive coming into this world. I'm thinking of very young infants, you know, 2, 3, 4 months old. As they get older, they're exploring the whole world with these fingertips, and they're getting tremendous amounts of information, and it's going straight to the brainal cavity, and it's growing dendrites like crazy. And even though they have 3 times as many neurons as they need, which die off at the end of the first year, what's more important is that the dendrites have started to make connections already as early as, you know, 3, 4 months, where everything is being examined with this sensory apparatus they have in their fingertips. So it's Aristotle, I think that was interesting. He doubted whether the sense of touch was a single sense, or actually more than one, sort of a constellation of the senses. It gave priority in the sensory hierarchy. According to the naturalist philosophers, and this has been talked about many times in academic circles, a keen tactile sensitivity does correspond to a keener intelligence. And we know that that's probably because, for instance, in children, because of more ability to explore and have more tactile experiences, which is very relative. We're going to do vision tomorrow or the next day, getting sense out of what you look at. And we need a lot of tactile experience to go to the occipital lobe, where you figure out what you're looking at in depth. In other words, having getting meaning out of what you see. And a lot of our I'm a vision therapist, we know that children who come to us and need vision therapy definitely haven't had enough prior experience, and the meaning of reading particularly escapes them, and they can't distinguish between some things they're reading, because it takes this exploration to do that, to be able to do it. I talked about Helen Keller, and she said that touch was the most profound and philosophical of all her senses. And when I wrote to her, I asked her which one, if she were given a choice of all the sensory modalities that she could have, she said she would choose touch beyond any other. Because she was magna cum laude in college, she was a writer. She explored many areas where you would think that she would not be able to become, you know, familiar with. She was a horseback rider. She did many, many things that I don't think a lot of people heard about. She was taken as a child when she was 12 years old to Switzerland, and she met Swedenborg, and this became her religion because he had visions and they spoke together, and she too had a visual life that was pretty unusual, and she was pretty amazing. She wrote to me, and I was a little frustrated. I wrote to her one time when I had 4 of my 6 children were already in school, and I was a little discouraged because I thought that their learning was being, I guess I have to use the word superficial, that it was not with experience and they weren't quite getting the beauty of life. And she wrote back and told me that I was right and that I would have glorious fulfillment from my work. So when somebody like that says that, you never want to stop working. I have a picture in my pocket that I took this morning at Narnia when I was talking to one of the little fellas outside. It was the little boy that went home today, that he only came today. And we stood by the sandbox and we got talking about dinosaurs. And I looked down at all the fantastic pieces of beauty bark. Is that what you call it here? That's what we call it in Whidbey Island. And I said, gee, some of those things look like things, don't they? And he picked up one piece and I said, I know what I think it is. What do you think it is? And he said, could be a head. I said, yeah. Well, if it's head, what shall we use for a body? So then he right away started to get a big long piece, and we started to form it on the end of the sandbox. And I said, gee, that's a big, long-looking animal. What do you call that? Well, that's a Tyrannosaurus rex. Right away, you know, this was a Tyrannosaurus. So we had to get great big feet, more sticks for the legs, and then two sticks for the arms. And this was a real, to him, then he had some other people. And some other bigger boys come over and said, yeah. You know, right away. That's neat. They recognized it. I took a picture for him so he could take it home with him, and I'm going to keep this one. Every thing a child can see, they build their world far beyond what we have, because they can see in many things that we have a name for that they're not that too familiar with yet. They construct something that they feel is analogous to what it is. And it's the way with sticks and pieces of bark becoming a dinosaur. They'll also give different names to things than are the real names. This is a great brain developer. When something is unfamiliar to you, as I was saying to the last class, that I said, as you get older, you never have to stop growing your dendrites. You might not grow more cells, but you do keep developing the brain through dendrite extensions. And that can keep you going till you don't know yet. But it doesn't have to stop at any age. It has to be something new that you encounter. It has to be a new activity, a new craft, a new exercise. Anything that you haven't experienced before will grow your brain. So I thought we'd do, well, first of all, I wanted to show you. We found this, and I thought, wow, I did not pick anything. I just picked it off the ground. I didn't break any life form here. But if you look at this, and there is a childlike sensitivity in you, you'll see what one person calls it, somebody else might not. Would you like to give it a name?
Star.
Very good. What did you say?
Star.
A star. Great. Does anybody else see anything?
A person.
A person. Because you can recognize, and that's what children can do. They have, maybe not proportion-wise, that doesn't bother them. If you can see child art, you know that they're not going to proportionately draw the picture. It's not because they don't know better. We're going to do art, too, someday, with vision. But we know there's two appendages, two legs, actually two arms, and there's a head. So it can be that. But it's also a star. That's beautiful. Yes. And I suppose, have you got anything else to say about it?
It's a flower.
It's a flower. A beautiful. It's a five-petaled flower. But we could, you know, a child can give you more answers faster than we can, because we know that that's a beautiful, still smelling wonderful, evergreen bough. We know the name of it. I have, oh, if really curious. I picked this up off the ground with my, while I was still with the little fella. He said, oh boy, there you have it. You have a scaly reptile. And I said, sure, I do. I need a head. So he picked me up a head really quick, just like that. And actually, the head had an eye. Isn't that amazing? Can you see it has an eye? He said, you can find your legs and arms because I have to go in for a snack. Isn't that wonderful? Gosh. I have to make the rest of it, I really do. Golly, this is ridiculous. I have to watch the time. I'll put this board that my husband was able to cut for me. I'll put it on the table, and there's a basket here, and I'll put those out, and I'll ask you each to come and put a piece of it on the board. And I don't want you to think that there's, like every child in art, we do not tell them where to place anything. We don't tell them how to draw. We should never tell them because they have a sensibility that's far beyond what we have in art. Picasso said, if you want to learn to draw, go watch a child. He thinks in terms of balance and composition far beyond what we do. And it's, Rhoda Kellogg said that it's an extension of the brain, which is your eye, and it's their senses of knowing that they have to have balance. So they put a house over here, they'll put a tree over there, if they have good vision on the gestalt, which is the piece of paper. So anyway, I don't want anyone to think that they have to put it in any particular place. I just want you to put it down, okay? And then you take all those pieces out and spread them around here so people can pick what they want. Because something will emerge and we will let it be. So if you don't mind, you can come up and take a piece. And in the meantime, I can answer some questions. A little hike, and this is where I saw the deer, and so on and so on. And that's, I guess that's childlike, but they can look at something like that and they immediately would have, everything there would be analogous to something that was real. And that's a wonderful ability that they have that we lose a lot, you know. But the marvelous thing about taction basically is that you will grow your brain. Another thing is that whether you know it or not, we're all researchers, whether we claim to be because we work for a program or whatever, we're researchers because we have the ability to make comparisons, see relationships, and make decisions. And those three qualities are what we identify in so-called gifted children, that they are able to do those three things very, very quickly. I worked with gifted children for 11 years in Los Angeles, and then I realized that all children are gifted. So we look at giftedness for academic prowess, and the only actual tests that are given for giftedness are for academics. They're now, since a gentleman wrote a book called Emotional Intelligence, God bless him, there is now ways to recognize that some children have leadership qualities that might not be that academically advanced. There are qualities that have to do with, in the arts, for instance, in movement, in dance, in many other areas besides academic ability. But we have always, because of, I think those intelligence tests started with the Second World War, and that since then we, and that was to decipher who could and could not be in the service, and we have not changed those very much. There are some now that have to do with personality, personality factors, which is pretty hard with children, and Wexler's and some of the others, but basically it's all based on academics. And the part in that is that it's based on reading. So we have missed a great many creative children because that's the only way we test. And that's sad because we need those. The creativity now is what the computer people are really looking for. Because if we had more creative people designing the hardware, the software, not the machinery, we would have other things besides combat games, etc., that the children have so much of. And I had a class, I borrowed 20 computers from a gentleman in Bellevue, Washington, who shut down his shop to come out to the island and place his 20 computers in my center. And within, you know, a couple of days, we had 20 children, but there were only a couple of girls and the rest were boys. And within 1 week, he taught them to write their own programs. And he said, now see the difference between what is written by, what is comprised by the boys and the girls. And there was a total, it was pretty shocking because the boys had, everything was competitive and combat and so forth, which is what they had seen, but they could very imaginatively design some new air games and so forth. But the girls designed writing poetry in the shapes of the forms of what they were writing about, like a tree. I remember one computer that had a tree that was shaped. Another girl had design elements that would actually make other kinds of things. It was like a different dimension that they would, you would see, but you would think of something else. It was so creative and fantastic. It was so different, and we don't have enough women writing software for us. It's always been sort of a male occupation position. I have in here something beautiful. I have the old and young of growth factors, and this is like a comparative study. I think this will work. This is, if we did this with children, we don't need toys at all. The world provides us with so much that can be applied in terms of learning. I picked these up because the contrast between them is so great. And yet, the beauty, is, you know, with a child, they will be able to tell you right away that the leaf that has the holes in it, they won't see beauty as, you know, the whole leaf. They'll look for other qualities and say, they're just as beautiful. And they'll make the comparison, and they'll also make it to something that's relative to them. Because I've done this with children. Now, this can be my dad. The little one can be my mom. This one can be my grandma. They can make comparisons. But to them, it's just as beautiful to have this lacy kind of pattern as to be a whole green leaf. They really do honor older people and the wisdom, and they know about wisdom too. I'd like to have some questions before I look. Time goes very fast. Tomorrow I want to get into another sensory. We've got Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday to do vision, and vision has to do with art, and there's a lot that I'd like to tell you about the psychology of art. And vision, I would like to show you some exercises so that you could improve your vision. And then we have auditory integration. I think auditory integration is tomorrow. And I have to go through these senses so fast that I might overlap some of them. Auditory integration is actually a new field like vision therapy. They now have two people that went to, two friends of mine went to Australia, and they've also been to England, studied with some doctors that have designed some special tonal apparatus that can help you if you have hard of hearing, if you have problems with deciphering one sound from the other in words. Some children have this difficulty. This kind of treatment will really, really help them a great deal, and it's called auditory integration. And they have a center on Vashon Island, but they travel all over the world, you know, doing this. As a vision therapist, I don't know how many of you are familiar with vision therapy, but anybody here?
What was the word you used?
Vision therapy.
Vision. Oh, I thought
you were vision therapy is what developmental or behavioral optometrists have now added to their optometry. A regular optometrist will not have vision therapy. Ophthalmologists who kind of looked at this askance for a while are now becoming very, very aware that vision therapy truly helps the person who has had surgery on the eyes, because vision therapy is an exercise to improve the quality of your vision through exercises of the eye. And our eye needs to be exercised just like all the other parts of our body. God tuned us in right, but the things we have in the outside world, like our TV and our computers, and the limitations we have sometimes in body work, you know, in just plain walking or doing the kinds of things we should do to keep our body in touch, limits our vision and takes it down a few kinds of qualities from what we should have. It should last us. I don't have glasses, but I've been doing vision therapy for years, and I'm grateful for that. I want to help us all know all about the ability to have good auditory integration, vision therapy, and to have a sense of art that we had as a child. And we'll look at some of those things that a teacher friend of mine named Rhoda Kellogg. Has anybody here ever read Rhoda Kellogg's Psychology of Children's Art? San Francisco? Thank you. Well, we'll look at that. I will stop talking if you want to ask questions.
Can you give some examples of vision therapy? What do you do with people?
Well, I'll bring some equipment. Yeah, it has to do with ways that we use with the children and adults. My daughter is a vision therapist with the American Vision Clinic in Olympia, Washington. And a lot of the pilots, she has a regular routine of pilots over the past several years. They come to her to get their vision back on keel, you know, so they can take their examination, which they have to do once a year.
Does vision therapy help with aging eyes that can't see close?
Absolutely. When my husband can't read the numbers in the telephone book, I'll say, you need the Brock string. Mm-hmm. So he'll do the Brock string exercise for a couple of weeks and picks up the telephone book. Ha! He got it. If your eye is healthy, you know, if you do not have a degenerative disease, or if you don't have anything that isn't interfering with the natural state of the eye, the eye regression is caused in older people simply because they have a stability of, you know, of not exercising your eyes. No. One simple thing everybody can do that I've done for years, if I had glasses, I'd lose them. I said that to my dentist too. I can't have false teeth, I lose them too. But if you are driving, and you must keep your eye on the road, but if you make a point on your steering wheel, which is what I have, I just put a little sticker dot on it's red, and if you do a near point, far point exercise, if you look out the farthest way you can to on your horizon and quickly bring it back to the dot, and only for a second, and then put it back again to observe what you absolutely have to do for driving. But that near point, far point exercise is extremely good for your eyes, and it's something you can do. And then when you come to a stoplight, blink your eyes. That won't hurt, you know. I mean, you'll be able to see enough when the light goes on. But when you do the near point, far point, just like other exercises that we do in vision therapy, it's extremely, you can feel it, a little hard at first. When I bring the Brock string and you do that, hope everybody can have one to take home, you'll feel it. When I do it with people that have, adults that have never done it, ooh, you know, then you blink your eyes and you try to, you never do it longer than a couple of minutes to begin with, and then you can increase it a little bit. So. So everything that's new in exercise is the same way exercising anything. You know, you don't go do two hours of strenuous exercise to get ready. You if you've never done it before, you take it easy. The same way with exercising the eyes. With the auditory, we have words that, the way we test the children, we turn our back to them and say certain words to see if they can really get all the sounds. And there's a list that we use in auditory integration to do that. May I ask any questions, or have I kept you too long? Or a quarter of? I really appreciate you've been a wonderful audience, and I really like the creation there. I'm going to glue everything on and leave it here. Thank you all very much.